And welcome back. Urban designer Damon Rich, who is from Creve Coeur, by the way, was earlier this year named a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, the so-called Genius Grant. He was cited for originality and creativity in the field of urban design and his work to make American cities more democratic. Rich was director of planning for the city of Newark, New Jersey from 2008 to 2015. In 2015, he co-founded an urban design planning and civic art studio called Hector. Damon Rich joins us from the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Damon, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, St. Louis.
Hello, St. Louis. Do you get back here often?
Well, my folks live in U City, where my dad grew up. And our family occasions were usually there until my sister's family, my brother-in-law works for Anheuser-Busch, were relocated out east. And so now we have some critical mass here in Jersey, which sometimes pulls them up here rather than us down there.
Well, congratulations on coming home via the long-distance line, and in any case. But great to talk to you, and congratulations, by the way, on the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Grant.
Thanks so much. It's really unusual for these kinds of recognitions to go to people who do urban design and planning, even architecture. They've only had a few previously. So for me, it's really a chance to try to lift up the work that so many people are doing as we look at the ways that we live in this country, some of the challenges that we face, that we have been facing, and how we can somehow work better together to improve the situation.
What specifically do you think it's going to mean with for you and your work? I should point out that there is a, they call it a stipend. I think it's a massive amount of money that goes along with this, more than $600,000. How would you intend to use that to further your work?
Well, they do you a favor, and they parse it out like paychecks over 5 years. And so that prevents you, I guess, from making any single stupid bets. For me, both my partner and I and Hector, Jay Shin, we've spent time working in the public sector, in local government. And that's a place where, even though oftentimes your resources are stretched and structures feel sometimes not totally up to date, you are, whether you want to be or not, in the middle of so many people's discussions, debates, and fights about how the city should be built, whether it's about the height of buildings or the affordability of housing or the design of parks. You really get an earful almost every day of what people want. And that, for both of us, was really a challenge on one hand as designers to figure out how we could do anything that was helpful. On the other hand, it really let us see a larger field of play and sometimes put together, say, more complex clients so that a park wasn't only being overseen by the adjacent property owners, but there was a broader set of users involved. And for us as designers, that really sometimes brought us to the most unexpected and interesting, even visual results. Like, what is a thing made out of? How is it set up? How are the different activities arranged? So one thing that we're really grateful to the foundation for is giving us a little bit of license to figure out how can this kind of setup work now that we're within a private studio where we don't have necessarily the convening power or even the modest resources of a local government.
Because we just did a segment on universal design, let me ask you, as part of your work, is this something that you are particularly mindful of?
It seems like y'all are really good at programming your show. It was so amazing to listen to those universal design advocates on just before me. You know, I think it's not too controversial to say that the decades of activism that went into passing the laws first in the early 80s that led to real requirements and now, of course, to greater aspirations around universal design were one of the most successful campaigns to really generate interest in and to push change in terms of how we collectively set the rules for how we build the places that we live, work, and hang out. So, for me, it's always been something to look at in terms of other types of struggles that are around the built environment and how they can learn from such a successful history. You know, another story that has been really important to me came out of Chicago, where in the late 60s and early 70s, a number of neighborhood residents on the west side in a neighborhood called Austin were looking around their neighborhood and seeing a lot of empty and abandoned houses. And they started to try to figure out how to fix this. And flash forward maybe 2 or 3 years later, they finally get to the point where they realize that one of the real issues is that banks are not making decisions to make loans in their neighborhood, which eventually leads to things that people might have heard of, like the Community Reinvestment Act. So these kinds of stories of people struggling to create the built environment, the physical environment that they want, you know, that's really the tradition that I, as a designer, hope I can make some kind of contribution to.
Do you think this is all moving quickly enough? I ask that because we talked about the Americans with Disabilities Act, now 27 years old, and our previous guests had indicated that there's really a long way to go in this area.
No doubt, although I think you know, some of my heroes have really always made a point to remind us that that these things are always a long haul. You know, when I think about even the birth of a field like urban planning, it doesn't go back much more than 100 years. You know, at one point, the people who made decisions about how land was developed, what was built there, was a really small circle. It was really who owned the land. It was only in the teens and 20s that we began to see things like building codes and zoning that really were, for the first time, us as a society saying, well, you know, we recognize property rights. Those are pretty important. But at the same time, there's some real interest that we have as a public, you know, as a general set of people living together. And of course, those issues became more intense as people live close together. So, you know, I think about this work, certainly, like you say, there's a lot of mountain left to climb. But at the same time, we are hopefully still very early in an arc of bringing, say, democratic decision making into how we make the really physical and material decisions about design.
Well, that brings me to a point. You've been cited for your work with democratic cities. That's democratic cities with a small d, of course. I wasn't exactly sure what that meant, although, given our previous segment, I think that that's what universal design is all about.
I think that's definitely one way to think about it. I mean, it's funny, when I think back to architecture school, and I sometimes have the privilege of teaching in places like that, of course, you know, St. Louis has a couple excellent programs. One of the things that I find that's a little bit built into architecture education is the skills that you might need as a designer to defend your design, to try to convince people or wow them, maybe bamboozle them. And that's, you know, where I hope that I have a bit of still of my show me state attitude, but somehow persuade a crowd that your design is the correct answer to the question that is being asked. And for me, while those skills are useful, at the same time, they sometimes foreclose possibilities of bringing in more complex factors into a design. It was wonderful to hear the previous guests talk about their success in working with the people who are replanning and designing the area around the arch. And I'll be very curious to check that out during my next visit. But you know, I think when we talk about democracy in cities, we first have to talk about the basic building blocks that we've inherited, things like planning boards and zoning boards, places where at least the original idea was that people would come together around proposed constructions in the town. The people in favor would have their say, and likewise the people who have objections, and then there would be some kind of democratically appointed board that makes a decision. My godfather's sons, Jeff and Randy Vines, have gotten very involved, I understand, in some of these kinds of debates in St. Louis, and they've been rewarded for their work by being appointed, I think, recently to some of these boards and commissions. And so I'll be curious for their reports about how those debates and decisions happen in St. Louis 2017.
We are very familiar with the Vines boys. They've been guests on this program a number of times, and they're doing a tremendous job. Great advocates for the city of St. Louis. You do get back here from time to time and grew up here. Are you familiar enough with today's St. Louis to say how you might apply the work you're doing here?
I can't say that I'm educated well enough to give any real specific advice. I can pick up enough that I know that some of the challenges in cities where I've worked are quite similar and familiar to people in St. Louis. Struggles against disinvestment and uneven development. Struggles against long periods of time when the capital markets did not put much money towards certain parts of St. Louis while pouring money into other areas. You know, the part of town, if we can call it that, where I grew up in the metro area, Creve Coeur in the western suburbs, it was an area that was really only developed from World War II on. And, it was an area that, at least in the last census, was enormously segregated by income and by race. So, on one hand, I was enormously lucky to have family, like my parents, Nelson and Sherry, extended family and friends who really encouraged me to be curious. My father, like I said, grew up in U City, loved just looking around town, took me downtown to his office every Saturday morning. So I really got to see the entire metro area, seen from Highway 40, every single week. And even though all these people around me encouraged my curiosity, at the same time, seeing those things left me with all kinds of questions about how they came to be the way they were. I began piece by piece to learn a little bit from amazing people like Bruce Carl, who led a youth leadership St. Louis program that I signed up for to miss school every month, and introduced us to people like in a single day, like the mayor of East St. Louis and the chair of Boatman's Bank at the time, who was also the chair of Civic Progress. And those kinds of experience began to reveal to me a little bit about the real conflict that underlie the development of places that, in my experience, were so peaceful, like Creve Coeur. Places that, in fact, were peaceful, I think, to a fault, in the opinion of my friends and me, as we violated curfew, wandering around golf courses and parking lots and malls and other strange places, because we exactly felt that this place, something had to be going on somewhere. So all that is to say is that, I feel that I'm very grateful for where I grew up, and still the questions that deal with inequality in our society, especially as expressed through the built environment, remain really central to me. It's always fascinating, although usually depressing, to hear about the latest discussions around, say, city-county integration of governance, right? And therefore also of tax systems. It seems like it's something that comes up every 10 or 15 years only to be shot down pretty quickly.
Of course, many of the people who populated Creve Coeur and other places to the west abandoned the city to do that and left behind almost a wasteland in some cases that is probably pretty much the same today as it was when you were growing up.
Although, many of those disinvested places, that were really struggling with poverty and exactly the kind of abandonment that you describe, of course, were generally masked from, right? People like me who grew up in Creve Coeur, Chesterfield, Town and Country, don't even mention Ladue.
Yeah.
I remember an experience exactly from that same youth leadership program with a woman named Jane Elliott, who had developed a pretty well-known experiment with her third grade students in Iowa called the Blue Eye, Brown Eye experiment. That really were some of the first things that I think began to present to me a critical way of thinking about the relationship of race and place. It's also, quite worrisome, again, from a distance, to read about the taking apart of programs like, what was euphemistically called voluntary desegregation took place in my Parkway school district. And even though I could probably, with my colleagues, tell you all kinds of strange and unfortunate things about that program, it certainly seems unfortunate that that kind of effort is being dismantled rather than revised and improved.
You worked for a couple of years with the city of Newark, New Jersey, and I'll tell you, I'm from East Orange, New Jersey, so I know Newark, and I know that Newark for many, many years needed a lot of work. What kind of work did you do there? What did you do to help improve that community, which for many years has needed so much help?
Well, I was really lucky to serve under three mayors in the Newark Planning Office for about 7 years, and in large part, what I inherited was a system that again was set up about 100 years ago to mediate questions about how the city should be built between all the parties that might be interested in that, from architects and engineers and real estate developers and attorneys to residents and neighbors and community organizations. And so a lot of the biggest victories I think that we had during my time were, number one, the result of just lucky timing on my part. For example, I was able to work a lot on the city's very first riverfront parks, which also included a large-scale rezoning of land along the river and a couple other municipal actions. Before I got to town, there had been a coalition of community organizations and residents like the Committee Against Toxic Waste, the Ironbound Community Corporation, who had been advocating first against real environmental injustices that they saw, in their neighborhood that were causing public health problems and other things. And then started to work for some of the things they wanted, like more open space in their neighborhood, some public access to the water. And so, of course, that was the most lucky time for a designer like me to show up once they had done that patient and fragile political work of putting together a coalition. And that was the only thing that made these larger actions possible. Another example is that we were able to revise for the first time in 50 years the zoning laws of the city. And if people aren't familiar with zoning, it's really just the laws that a city makes for what you can build and where you can build it. And for many years, the system was very opaque, hard to understand, and therefore the people who most succeeded with it were those who had a financial stake and therefore had the resources also to hire professional teams of architects like me to take them through it. And so one of our real focus areas was how can we make this process serve more of its original aim, which is to actually bring together the many different, sometimes conflicting parties around a development to work out the best solution for the best value for the long term in the city and not just one person's particular financial outlook for the next year or two.
You really have to have enlightened political leadership to be able to pull that off, and I guess you did in Newark. What about the population in general, the man and woman on the street? What sort of input do they have in the kinds of things you do?
Well, Newark, as I believe, although I'm less familiar, does St. Louis, has a long and deep tradition of people coming together in groups to advocate for their neighborhoods. A lot of this came out of times from the 50s to the 70s where people were really struggling to keep city governance together and to attract any kind of capital to meet their needs. And so, the thing that I've learned best in Newark, and thank goodness someone was patient and willing enough to talk it to me, is that the outlooks and the views and the real, I think, local dreaming, right? And not that it stays local, but that it is rooted deeply in the soil of an organized community. These are the places where planners and designers like me can find the most interesting things, the things that aren't going to be looked at 20 years later as the latest white elephant or municipal boondoggle. These are people who we really can learn from as we try to design and build new things that we hope will be successfully grafted, right, onto the existing social life and kind of life force of a place. So, those are the places that, that I think the work of urban planners and designers can most successfully meet the kind of people on the street that you're talking about.
I'm not sure about this, but I seem to recall hearing it from time to time that we can learn an awful lot from other countries. Can we and do we?
I think to some extent, right? I mean, because the choices that we face in terms of how we want to design and lay out the places we live are not things that are contained to a country, right? Some of the basic questions are necessary for life. How do we get access to clean water and get rid of dirty water once we're done with it? How do we get rid of solid waste? You know, where do we actually put the places that are necessary to deal with garbage? So especially when I'm working with students and we're just trying to open up these kinds of questions, because usually, you know, you take out the garbage and you just hope the city picks it up and then you don't have to think about it anymore. But these kind of universal questions of how we live together are really helpful to compare to other places, to start to open up our own minds about how things might be different where we're at.
How about the integration of commercial and residential property? I mean, is that changing or is it pretty much traditional?
I think there's all kinds of real estate trends that, like any trend, are changing from time to time. You know, I think that the thing that I would advise people who are maybe first getting interested in these kind of topics is to really try to look at the larger picture within a framework of values. Urban planners like me have been most guilty of trying to make the things that we deal with, whether they be where a highway goes or where housing subsidy is invested, make these things seem like technical and highly specialized endeavors. And if there's one thing I've been convinced of in my work, is that while there certainly are many areas where you're going to need an attorney or an accountant to understand what's being proposed, usually the larger question at hand is something that most people can understand and have an opinion about. And so a lot of our work at Hector is about making those stakes and elements of how you build a park, how a real estate development comes together, what is a realistic ask for a municipality to make of a new development, and what would fail to make it pencil out.
Forgive me for interrupting,
sure.
But I'm going to have to, Damon, I'm going to have to end it there. Our time has just gotten away from us.
Of course.
But next time you're in town, stop by and we'll talk more. Enjoyed this conversation. And congratulations once again on the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship Grant.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.